Hello, this is Beatrice Pavia with part one of the pantograph of Friday, April 17th, 2026. We begin with page one, where the main story is a collage of photos with the caption reading, "Performers from Illinois State University's Gamma Phi Circus rehearsed the Lollipop Lyra Act for the 2026 Carnival of Dreams production. This act represents a carousel and is new to the performance. The nation's oldest collegiate circus will have public shows at 7 p.m. Friday, April 17th, and at 1 and 7 p.m. on Saturday, April 18th, at the arena, the CEFQ Arena. A children's carnival is also scheduled for noon Saturday." And this caption surrounds four or five photos of people rehearsing for the circus act. And our first main story is about education, titled Unit 5 Approves School Plan. This story is datelined Normal. After months of strategic planning and community feedback, the McLean County Unit's Board of Education adopted a finalized enrollment and building use plan Wednesday with an estimated $45.3 million investment in new construction and renovations. Cropper GIS Consulting out of Ohio has been working with the district and collecting community feedback for a plan that would improve building use across the Normal-based district and reduce reliance on portable classrooms. However, members of the public criticized proposed plans to close Carlock and Glen Elementary Schools as part of these efforts, and ultimately the district decided that both schools will remain open in its finalized proposal. Carlock Mayor Rhonda Bayer said there was a comment during last month's board meeting about the school board having to make hard decisions about closing schools. Bayer countered that the hard decision is finding a way to keep these schools open and successful. "That is what the community here wants, that is what the taxpayers want, and that is what we are asking for you, and that's my challenge to you," Bayer said. Under the approved plan, Brigham Early Learning Center in Bloomington would be closed and a new facility would be built for early childhood learners. A new building may also be built for students 18 to 22 years old, a program that now operates at the former Eugene Field School in Normal, but the district also is considering renovations to an existing building within the district. Several members of the public spoke about the need for a new facility for the 18 to 22 program, citing hot water and mold issues at Eugene Field, which was built in the 1930s. The district would also expand access to specialized service classrooms and individualized instruction opportunities for students with disabilities throughout the district. The estimated total cost of the capital projects was between $32.3 million to $45.3 million, which would be covered by bonds that would be repaid with revenue from the county's 1% facility sales tax. While some attendance areas for some schools would be redrawn, current students could be exempted to stay at their current school through the highest grade possible, provided they continue to reside in the same household. Younger siblings also may enroll in the same school as an older sibling, provided there is no break in attendance for the family at that school. The rezoning changes could affect 287 K-5 students, 200 junior high students, and 124 high schoolers. Full implementation of the plan would take place over the next several years, but no changes would be made in the upcoming 2026-27 academic year. A small addition to Towanda Elementary School and a majority of the rezoning changes would take place in the 2027-28 school year. The transition of students graduating from Pepper Ridge Elementary School to Parkside Junior High School would take place in the 2028-29 year, and the new early learning and 18 to 22 program facilities are planned to open during the 2029 to 2030 year. When asked about the number of portable classrooms that could be eliminated under the plan, Unit 5 Superintendent Kristen Weichel said the district could eliminate them at Cedar Ridge and Parkside Elementary Schools by 2030. However, Normal Community High School's classrooms may take longer to eliminate because of the variety of classes that are offered. Board member Patrick Manieri made a motion to amend the plan to add language stating that the district would construct either a new or renovated early learning center, although some board members argued that the plan as presented would not limit the district to new construction. The board voted in favor of adding the language before passing the plan. And with the enrollment plan approved, the next steps would be to issue requests for qualifications for architectural work for the new construction projects. Once a firm is selected, a feasibility study and opportunities for community input would follow. And our last front page story is about elections, headlined, Trump voting limits seen in 23 states. This is a Reuters story. The Save America Act looks set to die in Congress, but 23 mostly Republican-led U.S. states have recently changed their voting procedures to mirror key aspects of President Donald Trump's sweeping package of voting restrictions in time for November's midterm elections, a Reuters analysis shows. Since 2024, states from Wyoming to Georgia have imposed new proof of citizenship requirements on Americans registering to vote and limited the types of photo ID accepted at the polls. Officials in at least 17 of the states have opted to follow one of the Save America Act's most controversial mandates, screening lists of registered voters for non-U.S. citizens by running them through a federal system normally used to verify eligibility for public benefits. Most of these state changes are not as extreme as the Save America Act when it comes to how voters can prove their citizenship and the types of photo ID accepted when casting a ballot, according to the Reuters analysis. But voting rights advocates warn that these copycat measures could still disenfranchise citizens who lack certain forms of identification during this year's elections, which will determine whether Trump's fellow Republicans retain control over Congress. At a signing ceremony in March for an executive order to tighten mail-in voting rules, Trump called U.S. voter fraud massive. Trump's executive order has been challenged in court and is unlikely to take effect in the near future. Although most new state-level proof of citizenship and photo ID requirements are not as severe as those Trump has pushed, they still have really serious impacts on voters, said Danielle Lang, vice president for voting rights and the rule of law at the Campaign Legal Center. The bipartisan political reform group Issue One analyzed an election fraud database maintained by the right-wing Heritage Foundation think tank and found 65 total convictions of non-citizen voting between 2000 and 2025 out of about 1.4 billion votes cast in federal elections. That was 65 convictions out of 1.4 billion votes cast in federal elections. The Heritage Foundation, which describes the database as a non-comprehensive sampling of election fraud cases on its website, did not respond to a request for comment. The Save America Act's most well-known provision is its requirement that people registering to vote in a federal election provide proof of U.S. citizenship, such as a passport or a birth certificate. Of seven states that have imposed new proof of citizenship requirements in time to take effect in November's election, only one, New Hampshire, is as strict as the Save America Act. Chris Diaz, a legislative tracking director at the nonpartisan Voting Rights Lab, noted that many Americans are already required to provide documentary proof of citizenship when applying for a driver's license or state ID, and that the 2005 Real ID Act requires states to retain digital copies of such records. It just does not make any sense for a state to not leverage the massive amount of information they already have about voters, he said. Similarly, most states recognize that the Save America Act's limits on the types of ID voters could show at the polls, only unexpired U.S. passports, driver's licenses, state IDs, military IDs, or tribal IDs, are needlessly restrictive, Diaz said. Of 9 states that have recently tightened their photo ID rules in time for November's election, some allow voters to show student IDs, expired IDs, or simply any ID with a voter's name and photo. New Hampshire and Indiana are 2 exceptions where lawmakers have replicated the photo ID requirements in the Save America Act. The part of the Save America Act that officials in 17 states have copied more closely is its mandate that voter rolls be sent to the Department of Homeland Security to be run through a system typically used to verify the citizenship or immigration status of people applying for benefits. Historically, election officials had occasionally used that systematic alien verification for entitlement system to check specific voters whose citizenship status was unclear. Last year, the Trump administration expanded the system to include additional types of personal information, such as Social Security Administration data, and invited states to upload their entire voter rolls to be screened for non-citizens. 6 states have since passed laws requiring that voter rolls be run through the DHS system on a periodic basis. In 12 others, top election officials have opted to do so. In Iowa, the process revealed 277 non-citizens among the state's 2.1 million registered voters, of whom 40 had tried to vote in the 2024 election, according to the Secretary of State's office. In Utah, the DHS system flagged nearly 9,000 of the state's 2 million voters as requiring further investigation, but manual verification found only 1 non-citizen, according to the state's lieutenant governor. The initial results of those searches mostly just prove that there is nothing to see here, that there isn't a problem to be fixed, said Sean Morales Doyle, director of the Voting Rights Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. A ProPublica Texas Tribune investigation in February found that state officials in Missouri and Texas incorrectly flagged dozens of voters as non-citizens after running their lists through the system, suspending their right to vote or initiating their removal from voter rolls altogether. And we turn now to some local and state news. This story is headlined District 87 OK's Mission Statement, Dateline Bloomington. District 87's Board of Education approved a new statement of the district's vision and goals and spending about $3.2 million for Bloomington High School South Gym renovations to begin this summer. The district plans to roll out a communication plan that will be shared with parents, students, and taxpayers to highlight the goals to ensure student safety and fiscal responsibility, maximize student learning and engagement, facilitate a positive workplace, and maintain safe, energy-conscious facilities, Superintendent David Mauser said. I don't want this to exist in a place where we put it on a shelf and forget about it, Mauser said. I want it to become something that anchors our work so that our staff, all of us, know as we move forward, our goals and our vision are what those are clearly. The full vision and goals statement can be read online. On the district's website. The board also approved phase one spending for renovations to Bloomington High School's South Gym, located near East Locust Street. The district has been working with Farnsworth Group and Midwest Construction Professionals to create bidding packages for the construction, said Chief Financial and Facilities Officer Michael Cornelli. There ended up being a total of 49 bidders for over a dozen line items for the project, he said, which included masonry, framing, flooring, plumbing, painting, and other specialties. The preliminary budget, which was approved from January, was a little over $2.9 million for Phase 1, he said, with Phase 2 coming in around $2.3 million. However, there was one significant line item that requires more work than anticipated, Cornelli said. The electrical work was probably the largest disparity within the packet, he said. and it relates to the desire to ensure that there is electrical service associated with air conditioning. The electrical service is not proficient in the space right now, and the pathway to get there is just expensive. There were a number of adjustments, both up and down, from preliminary budget to real cost for more than a dozen line items, the largest being an increase of $283,000 for electrical work, Cornelli said. But the overall increase in budget was kept to under $200,000, and the board unanimously approved the budget. Assistant Superintendent of Teaching and Learning Nicole Rummel shared an update on student behavior, featuring Associate Principal Alyssa Swab and Emily Waddell from Bloomington Junior High School and Bloomington High School, respectively. Both schools are implementing multi-tiered systems of support for student behavior, which feature positive reinforcement for good behavior and enhanced support for students who are not meeting standards. For example, every student at the junior high and high school lands in Tier 1 support, including school-specific and classroom-specific expectation, a cash-like system, reward system for in-school spending, and a list of workplace-like behaviors aimed at setting students up for success after secondary school. After that, Tier 2 features targeted intervention, social and emotional behavior groups, and instructional supports for students at the junior high school. Tier 3 is more highly specialized for those same categories, she said. Bloomington High School has a similarly tiered system, with the chief disciplinary incidents involving tardiness and cell phone use, Waddell said, and the high school has changed how they track those statistics. I did not want to include that data in here because we have done so much different in the high school that I feel like sometimes it can be a little misleading, she said. If I were to show you the referrals, because we have our new cell phone policies this year, for example, probably going to look a little frightening, right? We are approaching target numbers. One of the main barriers to student achievement, though, is attendance, Rummel said. We have talked about attendance for a really long time, continuing to work on that with family facilitators, social workers, providing assistance to in those periods, she said. However, while attendance or lack thereof has been a hindrance to students remaining on track for graduating, remote learning and tutoring through programs like UP Achieve have afforded a way for students to recover credit lost, Rummel said. I'm sorry, I think that's pronounced UPchieve. UPchieve is available to all students at the junior and senior high with one single sign-on, and they can access the tutoring 24 hours a day, Rummel said. We can implement all the tutoring programs we want here at the junior high and high school, but nobody's coming in to tutor from 10 p.m. to midnight when UPchieve sees the highest level of activity, she said. Students at both schools requested math tutoring more than any other subject, Rummel said, with nearly 125 hours of live tutoring provided to the junior high and 119 hours to the high school, serving over 2,000 students. In fact, as of Wednesday's meeting, the number of seniors at the high school who were on track to graduate increased from 85 to 90%, Rumble said. And that is huge for us, she said. And Ecology Action Center to host Earth Day tree planting and workshops. This story is datelined Normal. The Ecology Action Center's Tree Corps is marking Earth Day by hosting a special tree planting event on Wednesday, April 22nd. Volunteers are asked to sign up to plant trees along Interstate Interchange during a morning shift from 9:30 a.m. to noon, or an afternoon shift from 1 to 3:30 p.m. Volunteers must be able to lift the saplings, which are about 15 pounds, safely handle the necessary tools, and be on their feet for 3 hours. Volunteers are asked to dress appropriately, including long pants and closed-toe shoes. This opportunity is only available for volunteers 18 and older. And for information or to sign up, you can visit tree-corps.org. The Ecology Action Center is also hosting 3 workshops on Saturday, April 25th on rain barrels, composting, and vermicomposting. Each workshop has a different cost to attend, and you can, for more information or to register, you can visit ecologyactioncenter.org/workshops. And this theater review is titled Well Plays with Storytelling. Well by Lisa Cron, currently being performed at Heartland Theater Company, is a delightfully self-aware and unconventional theatrical experience, one that leans fully into its own chaos while asking its audience to reconsider the very nature of storytelling, illness, and memory. Under the direction of Cindy Brown, the production centers on the two primary performers, which anchor the play's meta-theatrical structure with clarity and emotional depth. Courtney Monier as Lisa navigates the rapid shifts between narrator, character, and reluctant participant with impressive control, capturing both the humor and vulnerability embedded in Cron's script. Opposite her, the always talented Kevin Yale Vernon as Anne delivers a grounded and quietly commanding presence, embodying a lived-in authenticity that gives weight to the play's exploration of chronic illness and maternal complexity. Together, their dynamic feels organic and deeply human, allowing the audience to invest fully even as the narrative itself resists cohesion. The rest of the cast is rounded out by Dave Crostal, Audrey Sutton, Christine Desgarin, and Fouad Sefa, who plays a variety of characters throughout Lisa's life. One of the most striking elements of this production is its lighting design by Rob Fulton. Thoughtfully executed, the lighting not only supports the shifting realities of the play, but actively contributes to its storytelling. Subtle transitions help to really outline the blurred boundaries between performance and memory, while sharper cues punctuate moments when the play intentionally breaks. The design enhances the sense that we are watching something both constructed and unraveling in real time. That unraveling is, of course, by design. Well thrives on its refusal to remain contained, and this production embraces that ethos, particularly in its playful and effective breaking of the fourth wall. Direct addresses and audience acknowledgement are not treated as gimmicks, but as essential tools that draw viewers into the piece's central tension, who gets to tell a story, and how truth is shaped in the telling. These moments are handled with confidence and timing, inviting the audience to laugh, question, and occasionally sit in discomfort. It is a production that embraces messiness without losing intention, offering a theatrical experience that is as thought-provoking as it is entertaining. And the play is going to be shown at 7:30 p.m., April 17, 18, 24, and 25, at 2 p.m. on April 19th and 25, with a panel discussion after the April 19th performance. It is presented at the Heartland Theater Company at 1 Normal Plaza at the Community Activity Center at 1110 Douglas Street in Normal. The cost is $10 to $21, and it runs 110 minutes with no intermission. And here is Susan Hazlett's column titled Complicated Orders Not on My Menu. I'm a proud member of the Straight from the Menu Food Orderers Club of America. When dining out, I like to keep my food orders simple, as in, I'll have the number 3, please. Sure, I believe a person should ask for what they want and not settle for second choice, but I have also seen family and friends take dining experiences to an extreme with their ultra-complicated food orders. I'd like the steak and onion burrito with no onions, and instead of steak, let's make that chicken. And can you tell me if the chicken was raised on a free-range farm in Texas? Honestly, I don't know how the poor servers keep it all straight. For many years, my grandmother was a loyal and frequent, almost daily customer at the Dairy Queen in Pontiac. She always placed the same order, a plain fish sandwich with no bun, and a medium dish of vanilla yogurt and a small black coffee. Unfortunately, the unusual order required the person behind the counter to enter multiple keystrokes on the cash register. To make the process smoother, the efficient folks at DQ created a special key just for the Dorothy order. Talk about personal service. I can only imagine the hassle of trying to order Grandma's bunless fish sandwich today on an app or at a self-kiosk. When it comes to food, our family is pretty predictable. For years, we have eaten at the same Mexican restaurant with the same reliable server, and it's a good thing the server has a good sense of humor. Each visit, my husband goes through the pretense of perusing the menu before eventually saying, "I'll have tacos de carne asada, corn tortilla, steak with everything but no cilantro. Por favor." He always adds, "Por favor." It's the same order every time. Why bother with the menu? Then, as if the waiter has not already heard it 100 times, my daughter explains, "Cilantro makes him sick." The best line of the dialogue, however, belongs to the server. With a big grin, he dependably replies, "Oh, so extra cilantro, see?" It's nice to go where everyone knows your allergies. At least my husband's order is a popular entree that the chef prepares dozens of times a night. There are diners who can't seem to order any dish off the menu, no matter how broad the restaurant's offerings. Gordon is a guy who prides himself in never ordering from the menu. "I don't see seafood gumbo on the list, but I bet you have all the ingredients. Would you ask the chef to whip up a bowl for me, please?" he says, and without waiting for a response, turns his attention to his dinner partners. "Really? I bet restaurant managers love you, Gordon." Or there's the diner who abuses the privilege of learning the server's name. "Dustin, Dustin," this patron says from across the room, beckoning the busy server with his hand. "Hey, Dustin," he starts, as if he and server are lifelong friends. "I know you're busy with that table of 12, Dustin, but can you please bring me different crackers because I don't like any of these. Stone wheat would be great, Dustin, and my water doesn't have enough ice cubes." You can just feel the server cringing beneath his trained customer service smile. I get so embarrassed by this excessive behavior, I have an irrational need to make amends with the server by keeping my own order as simple and straightforward as possible. "I'll have a steak, please. Cooked rare, medium, or well done is just fine. And for a vegetable, I'll have whichever is already on the stove. Or if that's too much trouble, I'll just take the leftovers from the chef's breakfast. Thank you." Or should I say, "Thank you, Dustin." And here is today's Flick Fact question. Do you know what Dolly Parton, one of America's most beloved singers and songwriters, and 2101 East Empire Street in Bloomington have in common? And the answer is, for Dolly, that's where it all began. 52 years ago, on August 1st, 1974, back when that address was the McLean County Fairgrounds, today it is the site of a Lowe's store, Dolly stepped out on a stage at the McLean County Fair for the first time as a solo act. In fact, a grainy video of the moment appears in the Netflix documentary, Dolly Parton, Here I Am, when Dolly says, "Hi, this is little Dolly Parton. This is August the 1st, and we're in Bloomington, Illinois, and this is our very first show." And here are some calendar items. Art That Moves Us, 5:45 p.m. to 7 p.m., April 17th through 23rd, at Carl Health and Fitness Center on Trinity Lane in Bloomington. Each month, young artists take an active approach to art by exploring artists whose physicality and movement are part of their art, learning about labor-intensive mediums, and more. And Nourish and Flourish 2.0, from 6 to 6:45 p.m. on Tuesdays from April 17th through May 12th at the Carl Health and Fitness Center on Trinity Lane, a six-week nutrition education program. And this has been Beatrice Pavia with part one of the Pantograph of Friday, April 17th, 2026. I look forward to reading part two with you next.